See America, then design for America. The 2004 Sienna is what Toyota considers a major redesign, a new and improved version of its highly ranked minivan. Toyota engineered it to be bigger, faster, smoother, quieter, and about $1,000 cheaper. Toyota also designed in many small but important enhancements that make life easier for the North American driver. Many of these enhancements were the result of Genji Genbutsu. The chief engineer job of developing this Sienna was assigned to Yuji Yokoya. The primary markets are the U.S. and Canada, with some sales in Mexico. Yokoya had worked on Japanese and European projects, but never a North American vehicle. He had seen various parts of North America, but not specifically with the eyes of a chief engineer developing a vehicle for North America. So he felt that he did not really understand the North American market. Other managers may have hit the books on marketing data, but that is only one thing you do at Toyota. Yokoya went to his director and requested he be permitted to make a trip. He said, "I want to drive all 50 states and all 13 provinces and territories in Canada and all parts of Mexico." Andy Lund was an American program manager at the Toyota Technical Center assigned to assist Yokoya. He had an opportunity to take part of the trip through Canada with him. He related the following example of Yokoya's determination to go and see a small town in Canada called Rankin Inlet in Nunavut. He arrived at a very small airport and tried to reserve a car, but there were no rental car companies there or in the whole town. So Yokoya-san called a taxi, and a minivan-type taxi picked him up. He tried to speak to the taxi driver to make a request, but the driver did not speak English well enough for Yokoya-san to understand. Eventually, the taxi driver's son came out and translated. The taxi driver agreed to Yokoya-san's request to hire the car but drive it himself. As it turned out, the town was so small, Yokoya-san drove the taxi through the only roads in minutes and was done. Yokoya achieved his goal of driving in every single U.S. state, including Alaska and Hawaii, and every part of Canada and Mexico. In most cases, they were able to rent a Toyota Sienna, looking for ways to improve it. As a result, he made many design changes that would make no sense to a Japanese engineer living in Japan. For example, the roads in Canada have a higher crown than in America, bowed up in the middle, perhaps because of the amount of snow they get. They learned driving in Canada that controlling the drift of the minivan is very important. When driving on a bridge over the Mississippi River, a gust of wind blew him very hard, and Yokoya realized that side wind stability was very important. Driving through the crosswinds of Ontario, he was alarmed how easy it was for trucks to blow the minivan aside. If you drive any place with a crosswind, the newer Sienna is much better. When he was driving the narrow streets of Santa Fe, Yokoya found it hard to turn the corner with the previous Sienna and improved the turning radius by 3 feet. This is a huge accomplishment since the new version is also significantly bigger. By practically living in the Sienna for all these driving trips, Yokoya learned the value of cup holders. In Japan, distances are usually shorter. You may buy a can of juice, but it is more common in the culture to drink this outside of the car. In America, on a long trip, he learned it was common for one person to have one half-empty cup of coffee or bottle of water and one full one. You don't want to wait until you stop and have already run out. Therefore, you really need two cup holders per person, or even three if a person wants a cup of coffee plus two bottles of water. There are 14 sturdy cup and bottle holders in the Sienna, and there are numerous compartments and pockets for those long trips as well. Yokoya also noted the American custom of eating in vehicles rather than taking the time to stop and eat. In Japan, it is very uncommon to eat in the car, partly because the roads are narrower and trucks wind in and out. So you need to focus on the road and periodically take a break from the stress. The luxurious American highways lead to more relaxed driving, using cruise control. So he learned the value of having a place for hamburgers and fries by putting in a flip-up tray accessible from the driver position. This option had been previously adopted by Toyota minivans in Japan, but is even more useful for the North American market. The original concept for a longer minivan also came from Genji Genbutsu. Dr. Akihiko Saito, who was responsible for all of R&D for Toyota globally, believed in the design philosophy that small is smart. The philosophy is to adopt the smallest possible exterior to minimize the weight of the vehicle while achieving the appropriate interior volume. During a visit to the Toyota Technical Center in Ann Arbor, he took a trip to Home Depot. He just stood in the parking lot and watched, like he was in the Ono Circle. What Saito saw were Americans buying large things, like 4x8 plywood, and putting them into the back of their pickup trucks and Honda Odysseys. Back at the technical center, he also saw how a sheet of plywood fit into the Honda Odyssey, but not the previous generation Sienna. Mr. Saito approved the size to accommodate the 4x8 plywood for the new Sienna on the spot. The way of Genchi Genbutsu is ingrained in the country's culture. It is easy to point to dramatic examples of Genchi Genbutsu, like driving all over North America to develop the Sienna minivan, or standing in a circle all day in the factory. But what is most important is how it becomes incorporated into the collective psyche of all employees. It is really part of the culture when it simply becomes the natural way of doing things. Though this is the Toyota way in Japan, Toyota must work hard to implement it in its overseas operations. Obviously, building a Toyota way culture overseas is a slow process, and Toyota works diligently on it. But are they in any way hampered by the American culture? Interestingly, there is some evidence that they may be, if you look at a fascinating book by Richard E. Nisbet of the University of Michigan, The Geography of Thought, How Asians and Westerners Think Differently, and Why. The book compares East Asians, Korea, China, and Japan, with Westerners, Europe, United Kingdom, and North America. A series of experiments provide concrete evidence that, when looking at the same scene, what Westerners typically see are general categories of objects at a somewhat superficial level, while Asians typically see objects and relationships between objects at a more detailed level. In one study, Japanese and American students at the University of Michigan were briefly shown pictures of aquariums that contained fish, frogs, and the usual plants, rocks, etc. He then asked them to recall what they had seen. The Japanese remembered 60% more background elements than did the American students and referred twice as often to relationships involving the background objects. For example, the little frog was above the pink rock. Nisbet and his associates concluded that Westerners prefer abstract universal principles. East Asians seek rules appropriate to a situation. And the East Asians see the same situation in more detail than the Westerners. Now consider Yokoya traveling all over North America to figure out how to redesign the Sienna. If he is experiencing the journey with much greater resolution due to his Japanese heritage and the skills developed in Toyota's culture of Genchi Genbutsu, he undoubtedly got a whole lot more out of the trip than a Western engineering project leader would. He was not just going and seeing, but understanding the situation at a very deep level, and using this deep understanding to make decisions about the direction of the next Sienna minivan. The implication of Toyota applying Principle 12, go and see for yourself to thoroughly understand the situation, Genchi Genbutsu, for learning overseas, is both exciting and a bit scary. Thinking through the fine details of strategy and operations is clearly central to the culture that has helped Toyota become one of the world's most successful companies. So the Toyota Way principles are something every company should try to learn from and apply. However, if some of these principles are more truly hardwired into the East Asian cultural DNA, it will be more difficult for Westerners to emulate. Or at least it will require greater effort and practice for Westerners to get really good at it. We will return to this theme in the last chapter of the book when we consider what companies can learn from the Toyota Way. In the meantime, we have set the stage for examining more closely in the next two chapters how Toyota uses the detailed knowledge that comes from Genchi Genbutsu to make carefully reasoned decisions and ultimately become a true learning organization. Chapter 16. Principle 13. Make decisions slowly by consensus, thoroughly considering all options. Implement rapidly. If you have bought a house, you probably signed a zillion documents at closing, trusting and hoping that they were all standard documents that wouldn't come back to haunt you. Your lawyer may even have reviewed the documents and told you that everything was in order. This seems like a natural way of doing business to most companies, but not if you are following the Toyota way. Richard Mallory was engaged by Toyota in 1989 as its lawyer to help acquire 12,000 acres just northwest of Phoenix. Today, it is the Toyota Arizona Proving Ground, where vehicles are driven on test tracks and evaluated. The acreage comprised the northern one-fourth of the Douglas Ranch. Mallory has handled much larger transactions, and from his perspective, the acquisition was routine. A Stanford Law School graduate and attorney since 1964 in a prestigious law firm, he knew his stuff and assumed he would handle his relationship with Toyota just like he would with any client. But he had not worked for a client like Toyota. Toyota wanted to know how the seller acquired title and how title traced back to the original owner, the federal government. Having now worked with Toyota for 14 years, Mallory concludes, "Toyota stands out as the preeminent analyst of strategy and tactics. Nothing is assumed. Everything is verified. The goal is getting it right." His learning from working with Toyota has spilled over to how he works with other clients as well. "I am more inclined to ask the penetrating question, why do you do it that way? Do not just tell me what you do, the standard operating procedures. I want to know why. I also challenge conventional assumptions. I learned more about due diligence and strategic planning as legal counsel for Toyota than with any other client I've had in 40 years of practice." The principle: thorough consideration in decision-making. Many employees outside Japan who have joined Toyota after working for another company have had to face the challenge of learning the Toyota approach to problem-solving and decision-making. Because Toyota's process of consensus decision-making deviates so dramatically from the way most other firms operate, it is a major re-education process. New employees wonder how an efficient company like Toyota can use such a detailed, slow, cumbersome, and time-consuming decision-making process. But all the people I have met who have worked for or with Toyota for a few years are believers in the process and have been greatly enriched by it, even in their personal lives. For Toyota, how you arrive at the decision is just as important as the quality of the decision. Taking the time and effort to do it right is mandatory. In fact, management will forgive a decision that does not work out as expected if the process used was the right one. A decision that by chance works out well, but was based on a shortcut process, is more likely to lead to a reprimand from the boss. Toyota's secret to smooth and often flawless implementation of new initiatives is careful upfront planning. Underlying the entire process of planning, problem-solving, and decision-making is careful attention to every detail. This behavior is associated with many of the best Japanese firms, and Toyota is a master at it. No stone is left unturned. In fact, every stone is inspected under a microscope. Mallory had an eloquent explanation. "There is a classic theory of beauty that comes out of Greek and Roman art. God is in the details. Even the frieze on the Parthenon that is high above the spectators on ground level is perfect because their gods would see it. I think Toyota's excellence is in the details." Thorough consideration in decision-making includes five major elements. 1. Finding out what is really going on, including Genchi Genbutsu. 2. Understanding underlying causes that explain surface appearances, asking why 5 times. 3. Broadly considering alternative solutions and developing a detailed rationale for the preferred solution. 4. Building consensus within the team, including Toyota employees and outside partners. 5. Using very efficient communication vehicles to do 1 through 4, preferably one side of one sheet of paper. Broadly consider alternative solutions with a set-based approach. As a young Toyota engineer, you attack a problem with relish. You carefully identify the cause of the problem, take care to do a thorough 5-why analysis. You then think and come up with a brilliant solution. You detail the solution and run in to share it with your mentor. Instead of evaluating the idea on its merits and congratulating you, he asks, "What other alternatives have you considered? How does this solution compare with those alternatives?" You are stopped dead in your tracks as you were convinced you had the best approach. When my colleagues and I started to study Toyota's product development system, we noticed a distinguishing feature of Toyota compared not only with U.S. auto companies, but also with other Japanese companies like Mazda and Nissan. Toyota senior engineers and managers were trained to think in sets of alternative solutions. Moreover, they could think concurrently about how things like the design of the product and the manufacturing system fit together. We called this set-based concurrent engineering. It seemed paradoxical that considering such a broad array of alternatives required so much time and delayed decisions, yet Toyota was consistently faster in product development than its competitors. Getting on the same page through Nemawashi. Toyota Way Principle 13 includes the important process of Nemawashi. Make decisions slowly by consensus, thoroughly considering all options, implement rapidly. The process of Nemawashi is often used to describe how junior people build consensus by developing a proposal and circulating it broadly for management approval. In the Nemawashi process, many people are giving their input, and this generates consensus. By the time the formal proposal comes up for a high-level approval, the decision is already made. Agreements have been reached, and the final meeting is a formality. Though this is a typical process at Toyota, there are many different ways to achieve consensus. If suppliers or other parties could be affected by a decision, their input is required as well. For example, in 2002, Toyota became aware that a planned mega-development near its Arizona proving ground threatened the long-term water supply of the entire surrounding area. Toyota took legal action to stop the developers and worked to get a citizens' committee organized to protest the plan. But instead of taking an adversarial approach, Toyota tried to get consensus from all the parties involved, the developer, the surrounding towns, and their local governments. And they searched for a solution all could benefit from. Ultimately, the developers agreed to set aside 200 acres and pay several million dollars in infrastructure costs to create a groundwater replenishment site. Basically, for every gallon of water they used, they would purchase a gallon to replace it in the aquifer. As Mallory, who led the consensus-building process, explained, "The mayor, the developers, and the citizens' committee, all of the contending parties agreed that Toyota had served each of them well and had satisfied all of the parties from each of their perspectives. The town ended up with a more responsible, long-term solution to groundwater subsidence concerns. The problem was solved for the developers, who would have had to address it eventually, maybe 30 years from now. And it helped the surrounding communities that are concerned about irresponsible growth. Everyone came away with greater respect for Toyota, not only what Toyota did, but how Toyota did it. It is the what and the how that makes the difference, protecting the land for the next 50 to 100 years, not just for the short term." In simple terms, Toyota turned conflict into consensus and created a win-win environment for all parties. From the perspective of a lawyer, this is very unusual. Once you go to court, get involved with local politicians, and take sides politically, the usual assumption is that you are fighting against somebody to win. You win, they lose. Toyota was not satisfied with this, as Mallory explained. Achieving consensus, it's a belief in reason. Let's work it out. It's a combination of reason and pragmatism with this overlay of integrity and excellence. We were in a political campaign, but Toyota had no thoughts of smearing anybody. There was no negative campaigning. Now, let's translate this consensus-building behavior into a company's day-to-day business. Inside the company, everyone is supposedly on the same team. There is no reason to act in an adversarial way. Yet the most common problem I hear in large corporations is the chimney phenomenon. Many different groups are in their own chimneys and seem to care more about their own objectives than about the company's success. These groups could be functional departments like purchasing, accounting, engineering, and manufacturing, or they could be project teams that are implementing new software or even implementing lean manufacturing. These groups often seem to act as though they want their particular department or project to get all the resources and their perspective to dominate in decisions. They want to win at all costs, even if other groups lose in the process. Not so in Toyota. The same process used to gain consensus with these outside community groups in Arizona is used every day to get input, involvement, and agreement from a broad cross-section of the organization, This does not mean all parties get what they personally want, but they will get a fair hearing. There are a variety of decision-making methods all used at Toyota in different situations. These range from a manager or expert making a decision unilaterally and announcing it to group consensus with full authority to implement the decision they agree to. The preferred approach at Toyota is group consensus, but with management approval. But management reserves the right to seek group input and then make a decision and announce it. This is done only if the group is struggling to get consensus and management must step in, or if there is an urgent need for a quick decision. The philosophy is to seek the maximum involvement appropriate for each situation. One example of the Nemawashi process is the way the broad circulation of ideas works in the early stages of product development. Before the styling of a vehicle is even determined, Toyota puts an enormous amount of effort into evaluating the early designs and thinking through all possible engineering and manufacturing issues. Each design is meticulously analyzed and countermeasures are developed through study drawings. These are sketches that include possible problems and alternative solutions. When the study drawing phase is completed, the collective drawings across all engineering departments are put together into a binder called the K4. Referring to a structure plan, the study drawings that collectively address the structure and integration of the vehicle. One day I met with Jim Griffith, who at the time was VP of Technical Administration. He looked frazzled. I asked him why, and he said he just had gotten a K4 on a new vehicle to review. Griffith is not an engineer, so I asked why an administrator would get this document. He seemed surprised, I would ask, and said that Toyota is always looking for broad input, and he too will have opinions about the vehicle. He was frazzled because this was clearly a challenging task for a non-engineer, and he felt obliged to take it seriously and come up with some useful input. As it was, there were well over 100 signatures required on the K4. Jim was a vice president and very well established in a company with lifetime employment, so he could have just blown off the assignment. But he knew that if the chief engineer was asking for a non-engineering opinion and he had to sign off on the document, there was a reason. The process matters, and every member must take the process seriously. Perhaps he might see things that others missed. In any event, he knew his opinions would count. One way new engineers learn about Nemawashi is through the freshman project. They are given a very challenging project, something they are unprepared for and could not possibly do on their own. For example, one American stamping engineer responsible for setting up the process of stamping body panels was given the assignment in his first year of designing what is called a checking fixture. This is a complex device that clamps a body panel, like the outer part of a door, down on specific points and checks that the measurements are accurate. Stamping engineers generally have to learn how to use these, but not design one. It requires understanding the design of the part, understanding the critical quality points, and designing something complex from scratch. The young American stamping engineer did not have a clue how to start. He was not given any rule book. So he struggled and thought about it and finally started asking questions. In the process of asking questions, he had to talk to many engineers from different departments, body engineering, quality, vendors. In the process, he learned a lot about quality and design and met people with whom he would continue to draw on as resources throughout his career. The assignment forced him to learn Nemawashi by doing it. A great deal of learning up front makes for easier decision-making. Andy Lund, program manager for the 2004 Toyota Sienna, explained to me why he always uses Nemawashi when he is making decisions and preparing to present his recommendations. For some decisions, I may think I already know the answer and do not need input from others. There may be a department that is not directly involved, and I think they probably do not have much to contribute. I may, in fact, find the right answers on my own, but I will have a hard time presenting it because the group I skipped will challenge my recommendations and ask why I did not consider this and that, and the presentation will become a debate. But through Nemawashi, they will agree with the presentation because they have already agreed with it. So I will go and talk to that department in advance anyway, and generally I am pleasantly surprised because I get new information. By going through lengthy and thorough information gathering and analysis in decision-making, what does Toyota achieve? 1. It uncovers all the facts that, if not considered, could lead to a great deal of pain and backtracking further down the road. Execution tends to be flawless by most standards. 2. It gets all the parties on board and supporting the decision, so any resistance is worked out before implementing anything. The cost of addressing this resistance when implementation begins is likely to be many times the cost of addressing it in the planning stage. Dick Mallory could not believe that every concerned party, even Toyota's opponents, ended up thanking Toyota for solving their problems. 3. It achieves a great deal of learning up front before anything is even planned or implemented. The last point leads us to the next chapter and the final Toyota Way principle, which focuses on Toyota's greatest accomplishment, becoming a true learning organization. Chapter 17. Principle 14. Become a learning organization through relentless reflection, Hansei, and continuous improvement, Kaizen. The beginning of the 21st century has continued the turbulence, uncertainty, and intense competition of the end of the 20th century. Long gone are the days when a company could set up shop, make a product well, and then milk that product for years, hanging on to its original competitive advantage. Adaptation, innovation, and flexibility have knocked this old business approach off its pedestal and have become the necessary ingredients for survival as well as the hallmarks of a successful business. To sustain such organizational behavior requires one essential attribute, the ability to learn. In fact, the highest compliment we can pay a business in today's business environment is that it is a true learning organization. Peter Senge popularized this concept in his book, The Fifth Discipline, over a decade ago, defining a learning organization as a place where people continually expand their capacity to create the results they truly desire, where new and expansive patterns of thinking are nurtured, where collective aspiration is set free, and where people are continually learning how to learn together. Senge focuses on new patterns of thinking and learning to learn. In other words, a learning organization does not only adopt and develop new business or technical skills, it puts in place a second level of learning, how to learn new skills, knowledge, and capabilities. To become a true learning organization, the very learning capacity of the organization should be developing and growing over time, as it helps its members adapt to a continually changing competitive environment. Of all the institutions I've studied or worked for, including world-class companies and major universities, I believe Toyota is the best learning organization. The reason is that it sees standardization and innovation as two sides of the same coin, melding them in a way that creates great continuity. For example, as we discussed, Toyota has judiciously used stability and standardization to transfer individual and team innovation into organization-wide learning. It is one thing for individual employees to come up with innovative ways to do things, but to be transferred to organization learning, the new way must be standardized and practiced across the organization until a better way is discovered. This is the foundation for the Toyota way of learning. Standardization punctuated by innovation, which gets translated into new standards. Throughout this book, we have emphasized that the Toyota way is far more than tools and techniques. TPS itself is designed to push team members to think and learn and grow. Toyota evolved out of innovation, originally in making looms and then in automobile design, and ever since the leadership has worked hard to keep this innovative spirit alive. We saw, for example, how Toyota used the Prius project to revitalize a maturing product development process. Lexus also pushed the organization to new levels of quality and excellence. However, breakthrough innovation is only one aspect of the Toyota way. Possibly the most important aspect is Toyota's relentless application of the more mundane process of continuous improvement, which results in thousands of little lessons learned. The Toyota way involves the company learning from its mistakes, determining the root cause of problems, providing effective countermeasures, empowering people to implement those measures, and having a process for transferring the new knowledge to the right people to make it part of the company's repertoire of understanding and behavior. This chapter will describe how Toyota accomplishes this. The principle, Identify root causes and develop countermeasures. Unlike most companies, Toyota does not adopt programs of the month, nor does it focus on programs that can deliver only short-term financial results. Toyota is process-oriented and consciously and deliberately invests long-term in systems of people, technology, and processes that work together to achieve high customer value. Systems are not information systems, but work processes and appropriate procedures to accomplish a task with the minimum amount of time and effort. The philosophy of Toyota and its experience support the belief that if it focuses on the process itself and continual improvement, it will achieve the financial results it desires. Continuous improvement, Kaizen, can occur only after a process is stable and standardized. When you make processes stable and have a process to make waste and inefficiencies publicly visible, you have an opportunity to learn continually from your improvements. To be a learning organization, it is necessary to have stability of personnel, slow promotion, and very careful succession systems to protect the organizational knowledge base. To learn means having the capacity to build on your past and move forward incrementally, rather than starting over and reinventing the wheel with new personnel with each new project. Ultimately, the core of Kaizen and learning is an attitude and way of thinking by all leaders and associates. An attitude of self-reflection and even self-criticism, a burning desire to improve. Westerners view criticism and admitting to a mistake as something negative and a sign of weakness. Westerners are often eager to blame others when something goes wrong. The attitude of "the buck stops here" is the exception, not the rule. It is just the opposite within Toyota. The greatest sign of strength is when an individual can openly address things that did not go right, take responsibility, and propose countermeasures to prevent these things from happening again. Hansei. Responsibility, self-reflection, and organizational learning. Teamwork never overshadows individual accountability at Toyota. Individual accountability is not about blame and punishment, but about learning and growing. The key to learning and growing, not only within Toyota but in Japanese culture, is Hansei, which roughly means reflection. Hansei is a bit of Japanese culture that Toyota recently has been working to teach its overseas managers. It is one of the most difficult things they have ever had to teach, but it is an integral ingredient in Toyota's organizational learning. For many years after setting up shop in the U.S., the Japanese leadership intentionally did not introduce Hansei. They realized it was a distinctly Japanese concept and too alien to the American culture. George Yamashina, who runs the Toyota Technical Center, explained it as something like the American time out for children. Though in Japan, Hansei has a broader meaning. In Japan, sometimes the mother and the father say to the children, "Please do the Hansei." Some child did a bad thing. It means he or she must be sorry and improve his or her attitude. Everything is included, spirit and attitude. So once the child is told, "Please do the Hansei," he understands almost everything about what the mother and the father want him to do. Translated as reflection, Toyota finally introduced Hansei to its U.S. managers in 1994. According to Yamashina, it had to be introduced at some point. Without Hansei, it is impossible to have Kaizen. In Japanese Hansei, when you do something wrong, at first you must feel really, really sad. Then you must create a future plan to solve that problem, and you must sincerely believe you will never make this type of mistake again. Hansei is a mindset, an attitude. Hansei and Kaizen go hand in hand. Toyota is continually reflecting on Hansei as well. By implanting Hansei into an alien culture, at first in the U.S., Toyota has an opportunity to watch it germinate and develop in a new way. The Americans have embraced Hansei to a degree, but there are certain traditional elements they have rejected and new elements they are adding. Andy Lund, a program manager for the Toyota Sienna, also grew up in Japan as a missionary's child. He explained how Hansei is being adapted to the American culture. The Hansei view of feeling deeply sorry and admitting shame is a traditional Japanese view, but I did not experience it when I was growing up in Japan. Here at TTC, we are using a more gentle version. If individuals do commit a mistake, they will learn from the mistake and from having to report to Yamashina-san. It may be difficult for them. When you have to prepare a report for the president, you learn so much more. He will be looking not only at the error you made, but how you reflect on it. You will, of course, get advice, but the preparation for the meeting is when the team member will learn so much. Part of on-the-job training is to provide opportunities for your team associates to present to the president. We try to give all team associates a chance to present to the president what they have learned, and they will get feedback from the president about dotting every I and crossing every T. But to bring shame is not the goal. When I first started doing interviews at the Toyota Technical Center a decade ago, U.S. managers often used the term the obligatory negative in discussing their Japanese coordinators. The Americans felt that whatever work they showed the coordinators, it was obligatory to find a mistake or expose a weakness. Lund believes this is a cross-cultural misunderstanding of Hansei. People who have not been to Japan may not understand that the objective is not to hurt that individual, but to help that individual improve. Not to hurt the program, but to show flaws to improve the next program. If you understand that deeply, you can get through that constructive criticism. No matter how good a program or a presentation someone makes, we believe there is always something that can be improved. So we feel it is our obligation. It is not an obligatory negative, but an obligatory opportunity to improve. It is the heart of Kaizen. Hansei is not simply a philosophical belief system at Toyota, but a practical tool for improvement. For example, TTC holds formal and scheduled Hansei events at key milestones in a vehicle program, as well as after it launches the vehicle and the program ends. Like other companies, Toyota conducts design reviews to identify problems with the vehicle. But the Hansei is a reflection on the process of developing the vehicle. Hansei is the check stage of PDCA. It is used most often at the end of a vehicle program, but TTC is starting to move it further upstream, so there are several Hansei events at key junctures in the program. The difference between Toyota and many other companies is that Toyota is process-oriented. In one study I worked on with Tom Choi, we tried to understand why some companies had vital continuous improvement programs, while others had superficial programs that died before they got going. We discovered the top management in the companies with vital programs had a process orientation, while the unsuccessful companies had results-oriented managers. The results-oriented managers immediately wanted to measure the bottom-line results of the continuous improvement program. The process-oriented managers were more patient, believing that an investment in the people and the process would lead to the results they desired. In short, developing standard global metrics is not a high priority at Toyota. They do it as simply as possible. More important to them are the metrics driving problem-solving and supporting their process orientation. The most important learning measurements track progress towards stretch improvement goals, which is the process called Hoshinkanri. Hoshinkanri, Directing and Motivating Organizational Learning. The adage that you get what you measure is in a sense true at Toyota as well. Toyota long ago realized that the key to organizational learning is to align objectives of all of its employees toward common goals. The underlying value system of Toyota's culture does that to a great degree, but to get everyone involved in continuous improvement in a way that adds up to huge corporate improvements requires aligned goals and objectives and constant measurement of progress toward those objectives. The important insight here is that simply setting specific, measurable, challenging goals and then measuring progress is highly motivating, even when there is no tangible reward associated with success. It's approached like a game or sport. Playing tennis or even solitaire is simply not as much fun if you are not keeping score. Toyota managers have become masterful at setting challenging goals jointly with their subordinates and are passionate about measurement and feedback. This is the basis for Hoshinkanri. Hoshinkanri, sometimes called policy deployment, is Toyota's process of cascading objectives from the top of the company down to the workgroup level. Aggressive goals start at the executive level, and then each level in turn develops measurable objectives for the year, designed to support the executive-level goals. At Toyota, these objectives must be measurable and very concrete, Vague goal statements are not acceptable. The policy deployment measures and actions become more specific as you move down the hierarchy from senior executives to working level team members, while progress reports flow upward from the lower levels to the senior executives. Every team member knows his or her small number of specific objectives for the year and is working on them throughout the year. Creating a learning organization is a long-term journey. Anyone who has participated in creating a learning organization knows that it is a major undertaking. It has taken Toyota well over a decade to build an organization in North America that bears even a resemblance to the learning enterprise it built over several decades in Japan. Moving people from firefighting and short-term fixes to long-term improvements by adapting Toyota Way Principle 14, become a learning organization through relentless reflection, Hansei, and continuous improvement, Kaizen, is an ongoing process at Toyota. Chapter 18. Using the Toyota Way to Transform Technical and Service Organizations. Manufacturing companies throughout the world have applied the Toyota production system on the shop floor to varying degrees, and interest in TPS or lean manufacturing continues to grow. As companies experience extraordinary improvements on the shop floor, it is natural to ask how this can apply to technical and service operations. Many service companies that initially look at Toyota are attracted most by the technical TPS principles of flow and how they can apply it to a highly variable and often chaotic process. You can sum up the prospect of applying lean in service operations by the reactions of three categories of people. 1. Lean zealots. Manufacturing companies that have implemented lean with any degree of success have experienced people who led the transformation. These people invariably become lean zealots who eat, breathe, and sleep lean. Understanding the power of the lean philosophy through actual experience, they naturally look at the enormous waste in administering technical and service operations in their companies and want to go at it like kids in a candy store. 2. Executive decision makers. Rarely do executive decision makers have a very deep understanding of TPS or appreciate the power of the process or the philosophy, but they love the results. So if TPS works so well in manufacturing, why not try it in engineering, purchasing, accounting, and so on? Even executives of service industries like hospitals have heard of the benefits of lean in manufacturing and want to know if they too can get in on the benefits. Often this means an assignment delegated down to a less than enthusiastic manager to check it out. 3. Ordinary people. Managers, supervisors, or ordinary workers in technical and service organizations are so immersed in doing their jobs it is difficult for them to see the flow in their work. To them, what goes on in the repetitive work in factories is as different from their lives as night is from day. The idea that you can apply some management fad about lean flow to their daily work seems ludicrous at best. Unfortunately, for the first and second categories of people who are enthusiastic about applying lean concepts, there are no ready-made models of success in lean technical or service organizations to push the idea past resistors and the natural organization inertia. Cho admits that Toyota has a lot more opportunity to implement TPS principles beyond its manufacturing and is working on it. But there are already many examples outside of Toyota Way principles spread well beyond manufacturing. For example, we have discussed throughout the book how Toyota has continually refined its product development process to become the industry's best in lead time. Toyota has figured out how to view product development as a repeatable process that it can continuously improve. Recognizing that any process is repetitive at some level is the starting point. The problem of identifying flow in service organizations. In technical and service organizations, people are sitting at desks, working at computers, walking about, sitting around conference rooms, and generally busy moving from task to task. It is very difficult to understand the workflow in the same way you can map a physical product as it is being transformed. In service organizations, the work is often organized around projects that vary widely in size, complexity, number of people involved, and lead time. But if you start with the customer, define value, and then map the process that adds value to the customer, Identifying workflow can be more manageable. My associates and I have done over 100 Kaizen events on technical and business processes, and it is always eye-opening for the teams how much waste is uncovered once they start mapping the value stream. Another eye-opener is the discovery that the bulk of these processes are fairly repetitive, and standardizing them is possible. There are 5 steps to creating flow in technical and service organizations. 1. Identify who the customer is for the processes and the added value they want delivered. 2. Separate out the repetitive processes from the unique one-of-a-kind processes and learn how you can apply TPS to the repetitive processes. 3. Map the flow to determine value-added and non-value-added. 4. Think creatively about applying the broad principles of the Toyota Way to these processes using a future state value stream map. 5. Start doing it and learn by doing using a plan, do, check, act cycle, and then expand it to the less repetitive processes. Canada Post Corporation, Lean in Repetitive Service Operations. Canada Post Corporation, CPC, is the equivalent of the U.S. Postal Service. It has a commercial mandate, and leaders at this government-owned corporation operate with the same corporate governance as a private company. The profits are reinvested in the company to secure its ability to grow, or are turned over to the Canadian government in the form of a dividend. CPC has about 57,000 employees with 22 main sorting plants. Customers can access their services at 900,000 points in Canada, more points than all Canadian bank branches combined. They deliver to over 13 million delivery addresses domestically. Their revenues are approximately $6 billion Canadian. In the mid-1990s, CPC began applying lean methods to its sorting and delivery operations. The sorting operations are the central nervous system of the whole process. Mail comes in from all over Canada and abroad. It is sorted, it goes on trucks and airplanes, and it is distributed all over the world. Before the lean effort started in 1995, the situation was dreadful. The sorting facilities were more like warehouses. The focus in these facilities was on automation and faster sorting equipment. Yet most of the waste was between these value-adding processes and was being ignored. Steve Withers, an executive within Canada Post, held the unusual title of Senior Advisor of Lean. He described the situation as follows. We had a complete batch mentality in how we laid out our plants. In many cases, we were using equipment that could not be started up until we had a large enough batch. Mail went like lightning through sorting machines, then it was moved and stored. There was very little flow. The engineering philosophy was bigger, faster, and more expensive equipment in plants, which led to incredible point velocities and more wasteful movement and storage. We had elaborate forecasting and inventory control systems with people wandering the plant floor to expedite the flow. We color-coded everything to prioritize what to process next, but visibility was terrible and mail was often stored in overhead buffer systems that employees couldn't see. We had huge sorting facilities, much bigger than needed, populated with fast sorting machines and inventory everywhere. Some plants had thousands of pieces of material handling equipment. This led to large travel distances, poor quality, and long lead times, but quick sorting. As it was, CPC ended up going through 3 stages in its lean transformation. The first was point Kaizen, trying things here and there at various points in the value stream. The second was a big-picture value stream focus that systematically analyzed the value stream and implemented changes. By 2003, they were starting their journey into the third phase, building a lean enterprise. In the first phase, applying TPS methods was a process of trial and error. Do a project here, apply this tool there. But even then, CPC made huge, impressive gains with lean methods. At its Ottawa sorting facility, CPC mapped the current state of the value stream for the facility on a wall, showing how letters, advertisements, and parcels went all over the place in the facility. They discovered that from the moment an incoming letter entered the facility to when it left the facility, it traveled 167 meters, was stored and removed 8 times, took 26 hours of total lead time to process, and the value-added time of sorting, actual work, was only 12 seconds. In short, according to Withers, mail was sorted in seconds, transported in minutes, staged in hours, and delivered in days. The plant was a warehouse. As a result, in 1997, the Ottawa facility removed inventory and moved some operations to arrange the equipment in more of a continuous process flow. This was in a three-story facility, and they were able to free up enough space to empty out a whole floor of the building. This allowed them to move several letter carrier depots into that space and sell buildings or get out of leases, saving millions of dollars. Among the results, 28% reduction in travel time for the mail, 37% reduction in lead time, 27% reduction in storage, staging. A transformation of this magnitude, even in one facility, is not an overnight process and requires a continual cycle of improvement and stabilization. It also requires focused leadership all the way from the top, which CPC had. As a result, today the lean enterprise has become the operating philosophy of CPC, and as it continues to apply it to all its facilities, the benefits are profound. For the past 8 consecutive years since starting on the lean journey, Canada Post Corporation has turned a significant profit, far exceeding the profits before lean. In total, it has returned almost $300 million Canadian to the Canadian government in the last 5 years, and customers are getting their mail faster. It's all about supporting the core value stream. I have illustrated throughout the book applications to service operations. Some of the specific, detailed tools of TPS may be harder to apply. It would not make sense, for example, for a lawyer to sit at his or her desk waiting for a material handler to deliver a Kanban asking for the next legal brief. However, most lawyers have many repetitive processes that can benefit from a value stream perspective. Analyze the process from the customer's perspective. Draw a current state map showing the waste. Define the future process flow in a future state map. Develop an implementation plan along with roles and responsibilities. Track progress visually and focus on continually improving the process. To be effective, it may be necessary to reorganize around value streams. These simple steps will take you a long way. As I have stated since Chapter 1, the key to applying TPS in any environment is to focus on the value-added operations and work to eliminate waste. As you have learned in this chapter, this is a bit more challenging for a service operation because defining the customers and understanding their needs can be tricky, but with extra effort it can be done. When Glenn Uminger, an accountant, was given the assignment to set up the first management accounting system for the Toyota plant in Georgetown, Kentucky, he was advised that he must first understand the Toyota production system. He spent 6 months in Japan and in other U.S. plants learning by doing, actually working in manufacturing. It became evident to Uminger that he did not need to set up the same complex accounting system he had set up at a former company. He explained, "If the system I set up in the parts supplier I previously worked for was a 10 in complexity, the Toyota system I set up was a 3. It was simpler and far more efficient." The system was simpler because Uminger took the time to understand the manufacturing system, the customer for which he was a supplier of services. He needed to build an accounting system that supported the real needs of the actual manufacturing system that Toyota set up. Through Genchi Genbutsu, he developed a deep understanding of the Toyota production system in action. He learned that Toyota's system is based on pull and has so little inventory that the complex inventory tracking systems his former company used were unnecessary, and the arduous and expensive task of taking physical inventory could be greatly streamlined. Toyota does physical inventory twice per year and uses the work teams to facilitate it. Tags are prepared for the work teams for inventory counting, and the team leader does a count in 10 minutes at the end of the shift and writes the numbers on the tags. Someone from accounting collects the tags and enters them in the computer. That same evening, the inventory count is completed. They spend a few hours twice a year, and it is done. Because of his experience of implementing the accounting system at the Toyota plant, Uminger had developed such a deep understanding of TPS that they put him in charge of creating a TPS office to do projects to improve operations in the plant and teach TPS. He then became the material logistics manager to apply TPS to the logistics network and became responsible for that network for all of North America. The point is that it is impossible to define value in a service operation without first understanding its core value stream. Some service operations are the core value stream, as we saw in the case of the Canada Post Corporation. In a legal office, the lawyers are part of the core value stream. Once you define the core value stream, then all support service operations must view their roles as supporting the core value stream. The leaner the core value stream, the leaner the support operations can be. Generally, it is recommended to start by applying TPS to the core value stream and then branch out to the support functions. In the final chapter, we will discuss how to learn the broader lessons of the Toyota Way and apply them to your company. It is this broader philosophy, the way Toyota leads people and partners, solves problems, and learns, that is the most difficult for organizations to adapt, develop, and sustain. Chapter 19. Build your own lean learning enterprise, borrowing from the Toyota Way. The toughest and most basic challenge for companies that want to learn from Toyota is how to create an aligned organization of individuals who each have the DNA of the organization and are continually learning together to add value to the customer. Will Rogers, American social commentator, said, "We are a great people to get tired of anything awful quick. We just jump from one extreme to another." I'm afraid that is what most companies are doing with lean manufacturing. It is just one more thing to jump into and one more thing to jump away from when the next fad comes along. If there is anything to learn from Toyota, it is the importance of developing a system and sticking with it and improving it. You cannot become a learning organization by jumping willy-nilly from fad to fad. The Toyota Way model was intentionally built from the ground up, starting with the philosophy. And the philosophy starts with the chief executives of the organization. What should their goal be? To build an enterprise for the long term that delivers exceptional value to customers and society. And this requires long-term thinking and continuity of leadership. It may take decades to lay the foundation for radically transforming the organization's culture. A prerequisite to change is for top management to have an understanding and commitment to leveraging the Toyota Way to become a lean learning organization. This understanding and commitment extends to building the lean systems and culture and, the most difficult for Western companies, sustaining and constantly improving the system. These are really two different skills, and even Toyota struggles with the balance, particularly in overseas operations. Why changing culture is so difficult? Culture change is a complex topic in its own right and the subject of many books. This became most evident to Toyota in its efforts to globalize in the 1980s. To Toyota, globalization did not mean purchasing capacity in other countries. Globalization meant exporting the Toyota culture to build autonomous divisions in other countries that reproduced the DNA of Toyota. What is culture? There are many definitions, but one thing is for sure. What you see and hear when you walk into a company for the first time are only surface manifestations of culture. What many visitors to Toyota and its affiliates see when they visit are surface features such as Kanban, high employee suggestion rates, clean floors, lots of charts and visuals, cells, and teams. The most common question I have heard when taking groups on tours of Toyota plants is, how do you reward your people to get them so involved? A reward system itself is simply a surface manifestation of culture. It is a human resource tool, something easy to manipulate and only the tip of the iceberg. Below the surface is the Toyota Way culture. In fact, Toyota takes a textbook approach to developing culture. 13 tips for transitioning your company to a lean enterprise. We can learn a great deal from the few companies out there run by experienced and talented lean leaders who have really been successful at effecting change at the cultural level. It is clear there are a variety of ways of doing this. At Wiremold, the CEO, Art Burns, started by personally leading Kaizen events to shake up the organization with radical change in high opportunity areas. Keith Allman at Merillat took a two-pronged approach. He hired a few young and talented lean change agents to work quietly on creating model lines, discussed below. For the rest of the company, he personally taught courses on lean and on the specific tools he wanted them to implement in the first year. He started with 5S. Each year, he rolled out an additional level of tools and management changes, teaching the employees along the way while putting in management objectives committed to implementing the tools. Top experts in the field were brought into the company to teach other tools like value stream mapping and standardized work. Despite different approaches, both lean managers started immediately with action in their core value streams. In a manufacturing plant, this means the shop floor. In a product development organization, it means the product development process. In a bank, it means the core business processes that affect the bottom line, like loan transactions. Here are 13 general tips on what works in transitioning a company into a lean enterprise. 1. Start with action in the technical system. Follow quickly with cultural change. Most companies attempting a lean transformation focus on the process layer of the 4P model, and this is in fact the right approach, as the technical systems of lean drive the Toyota way behaviors, such as surfacing problems that employees must learn how to solve. But the social and technical systems of TPS are intertwined. If a company wants to change the culture, it must also develop true lean leaders who can reinforce and lead that cultural change. The best way a company can develop this is through action to improve the company's core value streams, supported by committed leaders who reinforce culture change. Leaders must be involved in the value stream mapping and shop floor transformation so they can learn to see waste. 2. Learn by doing first and training second. I have been involved in many corporate startups of lean, and someone will inevitably say, before we can get started with all these radical changes, we need to inform people of what we are doing through training courses. This has led to elaborate corporate training programs with PowerPoint presentations. Unfortunately, you cannot PowerPoint your way to lean. The Toyota way is about learning by doing. I believe that in the early stages of lean transformation, there should be at least 80% doing and 20% training and informing. The best training is training followed by immediately doing, or doing followed by immediate training. The Toyota approach to training is to put people in difficult situations and let them solve their way out of the problems. 3. Start with value stream pilots to demonstrate lean as a system and provide a go-see model. Within a value stream, defined by a product family, a model is created. By model, I mean implementing the whole system of tools and ultimately human resource practices so other employees from your company can go and see lean in action without having to go to some other company. For a plant, this usually means creating one lean product line, beginning with raw materials received and ending with finished goods. In a service organization, it is one complete business process from start to finish within the company boundaries. The go-and-see model line should become a singularly focused project with a great deal of management attention and resources to make it a success and an object lesson in management commitment. 4. Use value stream mapping to develop future state visions and help learn to see. Value stream mapping is a method for clearly showing in diagram form the material and information flow. When developing the current state map, future state map, and action plan for implementation, I always recommend using a cross-functional group consisting of managers who can authorize resources and doers who are part of the process being mapped. The team learns together as they see the waste in the current state, and in the future state they come together to figure out how to apply the lean tools and philosophy. I have spent endless hours debating with individuals over whether lean can apply to their particular situation since they do not have the high volumes and repetitive processes of Toyota. I have never had that debate in the value stream mapping workshop because the mapping creates a language and tool for the team to actually pick apart a specific process, see the waste, develop a lean vision, and apply it to that particular process. Value stream mapping should be applied only to specific product families that will be immediately transformed. I know many cases where top management mandated mapping an entire plant and all the products in it, and the result was a lot of value stream wallpaper in the conference room. 5. Use Kaizen workshops to teach and make rapid changes. The Kaizen workshop is a remarkable social invention that frees up a cross-functional team to make changes in a week that otherwise can drag on for months. Selecting the right people for the team is critical, as is setting aside the time for those individuals and giving them a lot of management support. Using a talented and experienced facilitator who has a deep understanding of lean tools and philosophy with a specific problem to tackle, makes all the difference in what you can accomplish. However, the Kaizen workshop should not become an end in itself. In many companies, lean efforts revolve around having numerous workshops. The more, the better. This leads to point Kaizen, fixing individual problems without straightening out the core value stream. Kaizen workshops are best used as one tool to implement specific improvements guided by a future state value stream map. 6. Organize around value streams. In most organizations, management is organized by process or function. In a factory, there is a manager of the paint department, a manager of the assembly department, and a manager of the maintenance department. In a bank, there may be a manager of order processing, a manager of order fulfillment, a manager of customer complaints, etc. In other words, managers own steps in the process of creating value for customers, and nobody is responsible for the value stream. In lean thinking, Womack and Jones recommend creating value stream managers who have complete responsibility for the value stream and can answer to the customer. 7. Make it mandatory. If a company looks at lean transformation as a nice thing to do in any spare time or as voluntary, it will simply not happen. 8. A crisis may prompt a lean movement, but may not be necessary to turn a company around. A sinking ship certainly mobilizes management and the workforce into getting serious about lean. What is important is that lean leadership is focused on long-term learning. 9. Be opportunistic in identifying opportunities for big financial impacts. I have emphasized throughout the book that Toyota focuses on improving processes, confident that this in turn will improve financial results. However, when a company does not yet believe in the lean philosophy, heart and soul, it is particularly important to achieve some big wins. By picking the right product family and with experienced lean expertise, a serious effort has about a 100% chance of making huge and visible improvements that will impress any executive. 10. Realign metrics with a value stream perspective. You get what you measure has become a truism in most companies, but metrics are used very differently by Toyota compared to most companies. They are an overall tool for tracking progress of the company, and they are a key tool for continuous improvement. At most companies, they are mainly a tool for short-term cost control by managers who do not understand what they are managing. For example, companies track indirect-direct labor ratios and call to the carpet those with unfavorable ratios. The way to make the ratio look good is to have lots of direct labor and keep those people busy making parts, even if they are overproducing or doing wasteful jobs. Creating a team leader role for support, like Toyota's structure, means damaging that ratio and a short path to the unemployment line. The first step, therefore, is to eliminate non-lean metrics that are wreaking havoc with those seriously invested in improving operational excellence. The next step is to measure a variety of value stream metrics from lead time to inventory levels to first-pass quality, and treat these metrics as seriously as labor productivity and other short-term cost metrics. 11. Build on your company's roots to develop your own way. Toyota has its way. You need to have your way. When Toyota works with companies to teach TPS, they insist that the companies develop their own system. It is okay to borrow some of the insights from the Toyota way, and I recommend adopting the basic principles in this book. But you need to put them into your language in a way that fits your business and technical context. The Toyota way evolved through some inspired leaders who provided a very rich cultural heritage. Your company probably has a rich heritage as well. A large majority of business startups fail within the first 3 years. If you are reading this book hoping to improve your company, most likely you are one of the survivors. Someone did something right to get you to this point. Build on that. When we first started working with Ford to help develop the Ford production system, we held seminars for senior management and handed out copies of Henry Ford's book, Today and Tomorrow. This book inspired generations of Toyota senior managers, yet astonishingly few Ford managers had ever read the book. Build on your company's heritage to identify what you stand for. 12. Hire or develop lean leaders and develop a succession system. Leaders must thoroughly understand, believe in, and live the company's way. All leaders must understand the work in detail and know how to involve people. If the top is not driving the transformation, it will not happen. 13. Use experts for teaching and getting quick results. The word sensei is used in Japan with some reverence to refer to a teacher who has mastered the subject. A company needs a sensei to provide technical assistance and change management advice when it is trying something for the first time. This teacher will help facilitate the transformation, get quick results, and keep the momentum building. But a good teacher will not bore you all for you. If you want a lean organization, you need to get lean knowledge into your company, either by hiring experts with a minimum of 5 years lean experience, or by hiring outside experts as consultants. An expert, whether internal or external, can quick start the process by educating through action. But to develop a lean learning enterprise, you need to build internal expertise. Senior executives, improvement experts, and group leaders who believe in the philosophy and will spread lean throughout the organization over time. Having said all this, the question remains, can a company transform and sustain a culture to become a lean learning organization? If a company can maintain continuity of leadership over time, I see no reason why it cannot profit by implementing its version of the Toyota Way principles. It will not be easy. Typical obstacles may be reluctant top managers who do not understand, managers willing to try lean tools but not committed to following through, a management shake-up from committed lean leaders to anti-lean managers, a market that goes sour, or a buyout. We also mentioned that there may be cultural barriers to following the Toyota Way. There are a litany of cultural traits that differ between Japanese and Americans and French and Germans, etc. For example, we saw that the philosophies underlying Hansei that Toyota considers necessary for Kaizen are rooted in Japanese upbringing. And there is even some evidence that Asians more naturally do Genchi Genbutsu and observe things in greater detail. Yet, the Toyota Way is working and prospering within Toyota affiliates around the world, albeit with a great investment of time and energy by Toyota in developing its unique culture. And the Toyota Way is evolving as it adapts to other cultures, probably making Toyota an even stronger company. Even though there are plenty of uncertainties and challenges, my advice is start adopting your version of Toyota Way principles. As you have seen in this book, it is very feasible, and there are successes to emulate. If Toyota is any example, the rewards and results will far outweigh the great effort required. You will simply be the best in your business because you will be using operational excellence as a strategic weapon. Good luck on your journey. This is Grover Gardner for McGraw-Hill Audio. Thank you for listening. This audiobook is co-published by American Media International, LLC, and Redwood Audiobooks, and is based upon the book entitled The Toyota Way by Jeffrey K. Leiker, copyrighted in 2004 in the name of McGraw-Hill. Published by arrangement with the McGraw-Hill Companies, Incorporated.